Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled, Your Honor, You Do Have Jurisdiction. I'm J.J. Area, AILA's Education and Resources Associate, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Elise Schugel from East Palo Alto, California. Joining Elise is Paul Grotus from New York, New York, and Chuck Roth from Chicago, Illinois. The speakers have selected some written materials for this podcast, which can be found in your AILA Agora Digital Library. Go to agora.aila.org and make sure you're signed in. On the top right of the page, you'll see a green button that says My Digital Library. Once on the page for your digital library, you'll see two files. One is the audio file, and right above or below, a resources file. If you have any questions, you can email agora@aila.org. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Elise.
Thank you, JJ. Today, we're going to be discussing various issues that come before the immigration judge, including 212H waivers, continuances, administrative closure, TPS, standalone waivers, and bond jurisdiction issues. So it's kind of a compilation of interesting topics. And so we are going to start with updates in 212H waivers. So Paul, can you talk about the 212H waiver and the aggravated felony bar as it applies to lawful permanent residents?
Sure, I'd love to. Before I talk about that, I wanted to give a little bit of background as to the 212H waiver so the listeners could really get a little bit of a rudimentary understanding about the 212H. So before amendment in the Immigration Act of 1990, the 212H waiver was available to immigrants who were the spouse, parent, son or daughter of a USC or LPR who could establish that their actual deportation would result in extreme hardship to that relative. The amendment in 1990 did away with the hardship requirement, but made a 15-year requirement prior to the submission of the application in order to be eligible. That 15-year requirement can be alternated with a showing of extreme hardships. Now, there's a long laundry list of convictions that the 212H can waive. However, the sad fact is that no change that we're going to talk about today will allow the 212H waiver to waive away an illicit trafficking aggravated felony. No matter if you consular process or adjust, you're still stuck if you have an illicit trafficking aggravated felony, which is unfortunate because I thought when the BIA decision came down, when the circuit court decision came down, there might have been a little wiggle room for a lot of people who represent immigrants with these types of convictions because they're so hard to defend against. But I really want to discuss the topic that at hand. The Board of Immigration Appeals has finally given in after 9 out of the 12 Circuit Court of Appeals have accepted the proposition that an LPR who got his green card through adjustment of status as opposed to consular processing can waive an aggravated felony conviction with a 212H waiver. Now, adjustment of status means that you get your green card while already in the United States. And consular process means you apply for and receive the green card at the consulate in your home country. Now, I ask a lot of my clients who have these kinds of issues, when did they actually get the green card? And they say, well, I got it in the U.S., and I'm so excited. But after a little further investigation, they consular processed, and they came to the airport and were given a temporary green card, and the actual green card was physically mailed to them later on. So, unfortunately, that still counts as consular processing. If you consular process, you are still out of luck for a 212H waiver for an aggravated felony, even if the green card was mailed to you after you already came into the United States of America. Now, as I was saying before, the 212H waiver will only waive away aggravated felonies for LPRs as if it would waive away, the 212H waiver would waive away any other aggravated felony. You can't just start applying the 212H waiver to every aggravated felony out there, which is unfortunate, but that's the rule that we're stuck with.
And Paul, can you tell us where that limitation comes from?
The limitation specifically on the type of aggravated felony?
Well, both the type of aggravated felony and the distinction between permanent residents who consular processed versus permanent residents who adjusted status within the United States.
Sure. So the limitation on consular processing versus adjustment comes specifically from the plain reading of the actual statute for the 212H waiver. And if you look at that statute, you take a look at the congressional minutes, it's clear that Congress intended the 212H waiver bar to apply to those applicants who initially acquired LPR status via admission at the port of entry, as opposed to those who adjusted, because those who adjusted have been in America for a long period of time, and they have built up more equity. So if you look specifically at the statutory language, that really allows you to differentiate who is eligible and who is not eligible. And in terms of
And we also have a board decision on point on this issue, right, in matter of JHJ that came down this year?
Oh, yeah, I forgot to mention that. That's the board decision that allowed the 212H waiver to apply to aggravated felonies in every single jurisdiction, not just in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals jurisdictions, which had already held in the immigrant's favor. It rescinded matter of Koljinovic and matter of E.W. Rodriguez. And in those cases, they said it didn't matter if you had adjusted or consular process. The 212H waiver was still not eligible for aggravated felonies. But thankfully, the board, they rescinded that decision, and they came out with matter of JHJ, which came out this year in 2015.
Thank you, Paul. And then another follow-up question. Does this rule apply or extend to someone who adjusted status and then traveled abroad, re-entered as a lawful permanent resident, and was charged with seeking admission and put into removal proceedings because of a criminal conviction? Would there be an issue with a person in that situation applying for a 212H waiver if that person had an aggravated felony conviction?
Well, I think that the key is the actual date of the conviction. I think if they're caught at the airport and they're considered an arriving alien and the criminal conviction predates the initial entry, then they can apply for a standalone 212H waiver. If they are not considered an arriving alien and as a mistake they are inspected and admitted, you can make the argument that they're going to be eligible for the 212H waiver. But it's going to be very, very difficult for you to succeed because they've already been inspected and admitted at the airport. And the whole gravamen of this argument is that the 212H waiver is eligible for aggravated felons who have never been inspected and admitted. So if they catch you as an arriving alien at the airport, technically, you've never been inspected and admitted, and you can apply for a standalone 212H waiver.
Okay, and then just a follow-up on that, the question that was addressed in the board's decision in JHJ was that distinction between someone adjusting status within the United States and that person is eligible to apply for a 212H waiver despite having an aggravated felony conviction versus someone who consular processed because they were admitted as a lawful permanent resident. And so can you just clarify a little bit whether someone who, let's say, is inspected and admitted as an LPR after traveling abroad, whether a person in that situation is going to face the same problem as someone who consular processed would face if they want to apply for a 212H waiver?
So there's no board case and there's no federal court case with this exact specific fact pattern to my knowledge. But unfortunately, after you have been inspected and admitted, it'll be very difficult for you to successfully apply and receive the 212H waiver. In the statutory language, the 212H waiver and the aggravated felony The 212H waiver for aggravated felonies is only really eligible for people who have never been inspected and admitted. And as a result, if you run up against that issue, you can try and you can submit a 212H application, but it's going to be very hard for you to prevail on that issue.
Thank you.
You can make the argument that it's unfair because technically the LPR was never actually seeking admission under the Flutie doctrine if his travel outside the United States was only a brief casual travel instead of him being outside for more than 6 months. You could say that he was never actually applying for admission because he was an LPR just coming back from a brief trip abroad, which would probably be the argument that I would go with if I was in that scenario. But unfortunately, it's going to be a difficult case.
Thank you, Paul. And then one last question for you. When a lawful permanent resident is in removal proceedings and is facing grounds of deportability under INA Section 237 versus grounds of inadmissibility under INA Section 212A2, which is what 212H seeks to waive, can a lawful permanent resident seek a 212H waiver when they're facing grounds of deportability?
I've done a fair number of these cases where the client isn't facing a ground of inadmissibility under 212, so I think that they should also be able to submit a 212H waiver under the congruent ground of deportability. I think that you can make the argument that there was a recent Supreme Court case that it's unfair to require an immigrant to match up the charges of removability for inadmissibility and deportability.
And what about, what about if you're unsuccessful on that argument? Can a lawful permanent resident, for example, who has an immediate relative, can they seek to readjust or apply for a 212H waiver?
Yeah, so unless your client is considered an arriving alien, you're going to need to include you're going to need to seek readjustment with an immediate relative or with someone who is a family member who could sponsor the person. So you're going to have to do the I-130 and do the I-485 and apply for adjustment all over again in front of the immigration judge.
Great. Thank you, Paul. And then on that note, that's a very good segue to discussing continuances and seeking continuances from the immigration judge when your client has a pending application for benefits for the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services. So, Chuck, can you talk a bit about common scenarios where you need to request a continuance from the immigration judge so that USCIS can adjudicate a petition?
Sure. Thanks, Elise. So I think we all know the general standard for motions for continuance. They can be granted by the judge for good cause shown. That's what the regulations say at 1003.29. The board has historically treated that good cause requirement, you might look at matter of Cibrun, as requiring a reasonable showing that the situation occurs, quote, despite a diligent good faith effort to be ready to proceed, and also, you know, requiring that the reason that whatever is going to emerge after the continuance will result in something that is probative, non-cumulative, and significantly favorable to the alien, which I think sort of adds up to it's not your fault that you need a continuance, and there's a real chance, you might say prejudice, there's a real chance that whatever is going to emerge from the, you know, an additional period of time could really change the course of the case. Now, Cibrun was a board decision from 1983. There have actually been a slew of decisions on continuances since, thanks in part to the proliferation of matters which are in whole or in part placed within the jurisdiction of USCIS. We can think of situations like, I mean, the most common historically has been where you want to adjust before the immigration judge, but you need to get an approved visa petition, an I-130, an I-360, an I-140, maybe a labor certification. Labor certification being an entirely different agency. But, you know, more recently there have been U visas, T visas, conditional residence, trig exemptions, and DACA, and hopefully someday DAPA. So the board has explained a little bit more about what it's thinking in those contexts as well. Now, I should say that when you look at the board decisions, I think one common thread is, in the end of the day, is there good cause shown, and the judge is supposed to balance all these factors and weigh them on either side of a balance and decide whether it makes sense to continue your case. So the length of time that would be required for the continuance is one factor that the courts usually consider. I sort of think of it in terms of negative equities sort of kicking in there. If the person seems like a sort of a bad character, the court is going to be, in my view, courts are less willing to grant lengthy continuances than if the person seems as clean as the driven snow and everybody's sympathetic.
Well, Chuck, so let's bring it back to what Paul was just discussing with respect to the 212H waiver. So a lawful permanent resident who is applying for a 212H waiver will not be clean as driven snow because that person has a criminal conviction that requires him or her to be seeking the waiver. And so if
that they actually did it. In fact, I'm sure they didn't do it, but they were just advised by their criminal defense attorney to plead guilty. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, certainly that's possible, but in the immigration judge's view, that person probably is not pure. And does have grounds of inadmissibility or a ground of inadmissibility that needs to be waived. And so if that lawful permanent resident is facing grounds of deportability, as Paul was discussing, then that person needs to seek to readjust. And in order to do so, would need a new I-130, assuming that person has an immediate relative who can file that I-130. And so in your experience, when there are going to be at least some negative discretionary factors due to the criminal conviction, are you able to get the continuances you need for that I-130 to be adjudicated?
You know, there's a number of things to be said about this. The first, I might suggest starting with Matter of Raja, which is a 2009 decision. You know, Raja says, you know, the focus of the inquiry should be on the likelihood of success on the adjustment application. And, you know, it goes on to say, look, you know, in order for the IJ to decide whether to grant a continuance, they're going to need to, you know, look a little bit at the merits of the adjustment application. They need the non-citizen may be required to submit evidence of eligibility, including the application supporting documentation. I think a judge would be within her authority to say, yes, I think you are eligible. Assuming this I-130 is approved, you're eligible to seek adjustment with a 212H waiver. Nonetheless, in light of your heinous terror, you know, whatever awful deeds, I would not grant you relief in the exercise of discretion. Therefore, I'm going to deny the continuance. And if a judge says that, it's awfully difficult to combat. I think all that's true. But I would back up and say I think, first of all, I mean, DHS has policy that says that the chief counsel will try to get that I-130 adjudication expedited, and in my experience, they can do that if they're you know feeling like it. CIS. Sometimes, I mean, expedited doesn't mean one day to the next. Usually, it you know means a few months instead of a few years. But nevertheless, I think it's often advantageous in that situation to really advocate with DHS to try to get that I-130 adjudicated, so you can really get put on a full merits hearing before the judge and get a you know, maximize the chances of winning your case. Because sometimes judges are initially disinclined to grant a waiver. They look at the crime, they think it's bad. And you know, on the paper, you know, sometimes your hardship doesn't appear as powerful as it can in person. And so I think, one shouldn't jump straight to the continuance. If you can avoid the need for a continuance, it's sometimes advantageous. I think in general, if there's, matter of Hashmi is also very, you know, where there's the underlying visa petition is prima facie approvable, and where you're statutorily eligible for adjustment of status, you know, I think once you add those two together, I don't want to say it creates a presumption of a continuance, but I think it often sort of functions that way. I think at that point it becomes maybe not so efficient for the court to jump ahead and sort of do a phantom merits decision by saying I would likely deny in the exercise of discretion. You kind of need to hear evidence, you need to take testimony, and then we start complaining that the judge didn't consider X and Y and Z, and you might just have a remand. I think once a judge is sitting there looking at prima facie approvable visa petition and statutorily eligible for relief, I think, you know, continuance often happens. Now, what can often happen, though, is the CIS denies an I-130 for one reason or another, and maybe it's an awful reason, maybe it's a silly reason, but now you're sitting there with a denied I-130, which you can appeal to the BIA. You could seek to reopen with CIS, but now, you know, once you're in that situation, a judge, I mean, everything is sliding downhill. It's all going against you, and that goes doubly or triply for, you know, I-140 or an I-360. For instance, you know, where the a labor cert might have been approved, but you don't file the I-140 within the specified period of time, so now you're not eligible. You don't have a visa petition that's actually going to directly lead to adjustment. It's true that you might be able to file a new I-140, but my goodness, you know, that's really downhill. And I think it's the same thing. Sometimes you have clients who, you know, they divorced. The initial I-130 petitioner is no longer married to your client. Your client's married to another person who's also a U.S. citizen. Boy, you better make sure that there's an I-130 that's filed. But even so, you know, once you have the approved I-130, but that's, you know, no longer going to support the adjustment, judges are much less inclined to grant continuances. And, especially in the labor certification context or in the context of a preference visa, which is not exactly current, judges really don't. And it's unfortunate, but where there's the quota is backlogged and you can't adjust right away, that's a situation where judges have an inclination to move forward if your client has done just about anything bad. Does that answer your question, Eilis?
It does, and just really briefly, I wanted you to touch on some of the other types of petitions that you mentioned that our clients can pursue while in removal proceedings, petitions that are filed with USCIS. You mentioned U visas, P visas, DACA, trig exemptions, and I'm just wondering what you try to show to the immigration judge to convince that judge that the person should be granted a continuance when that application is pending, particularly something like, let's say, a U visa, which takes, you know, 16 months to adjudicate.
Right. Well, if it's a petition that can support an adjustment of status application, and if the visa numbers are current, so it's an IR petition generally, one suggestion I would have is, even though you don't have an approved petition, I think there's pretty good arguments that you can apply for that relief. You can file the adjustment. If you weren't in proceedings, you'd often file a one-stop with an I-130, I-45, I-765, I-131. you know, you can't do that, obviously, because the judge has jurisdiction over the adjustment, but not the alimony. If you can file the adjustment of status application with the judge, I think that puts you in a much better position, because now the judge is sitting there, he's going to have to deny or approve this application that you filed. If you're in a position to file it, I think that helps you a great deal. Because then it's really like you've asked the court to adjudicate it. The court can't adjudicate it yet. That increases substantially the chance that you just get a continuance. But of course, there's other contexts where there's just absolutely no power of the court to grant. Sometimes there is the power to do something sort of similar. So, for instance, if you have an I-360 VAWA situation, your client might be eligible for VAWA adjustment, but they may also be eligible for VAWA cancellation. By filing your VAWA cancellation application, the judge now can't just order your client deported. She'd have to schedule a merits hearing on the VAWA cancellation. Much easier to just wait and see if the I-360 is approved, and then facilitate a relatively simpler application for adjustment of status. As to U's and T's, part of that sort of turns on whether your client has any sort of unsympathetic aspects. Non-citizens without recent entries and without criminal convictions aren't priorities, and so they may not be in removal proceedings at all. But, of course, that could change tomorrow, and, of course, chief counsels have sometimes different views of what constitutes a priority. So if you have a client who's a U visa applicant and they're in proceedings and they haven't convicted, it's very easy to get an extension. When you have a person who's detained particularly and is U visa eligible, now you have, as you point out, a very difficult situation, because even on the expedited track, U visa applicants have a long wait. You may be able to get a prima facie determination sort of earlier in some of these contexts, but sort of an unstated issue is that now with the U visa backlog, you can't even actually get to non-immigrant U visa status for 3 to 5 years, right? So technically, all you're really after is a deferred action grant while you wait for non-immigrant numbers to arrive.
Bring up something that Chuck was talking about. I mean, when you're in the U visa context and someone is an LPR and they have a very, very bad conviction, which they unfortunately pled guilty to, and they are eligible for a U visa, I've spoken with the local chief counsel's office, and we're in a very weird position, because what you're forced to do is take an order of removal so that the U visa can be adjudicated, and then that hope that DHS will adjudicate the deferred action application and not deport the person, which makes things very, very confusing, especially in front of the immigration judge in terms of the administrative closure context, because the immigration judge will say to you, well, take an order of removal and bring it up with USCIS. But it's very, very difficult for you to tell your client to do that. And it adds another wrinkle, bringing in the next sort of topic, is the immigration judge has the authority to adjudicate the U visa waiver. So then what are you going to do? You're going to take an order of removal, and if the U visa gets granted but the waiver doesn't, are you going to seek a motion to reopen to allow the IJ to then adjudicate it?
Yeah, and that's particularly complicated, as you say, with a permanent resident, because the USCIS takes the position, incorrectly in my view, that it can't grant U visa status to an LPR. That has to do in part... Sorry, go ahead.
No, that is a very interesting topic and conversation that's a little bit off our topic, so I'm going to try and bring us back to our discussion and jump to administrative closure, which Paul did just mention, and can be used in many scenarios, possibly in the scenario that you just mentioned, Paul, although admittedly that would be difficult if you have a removal order. Then you have a removal order, and then you'd have issues with administrative closure and would really need a stay of removal instead. But administrative closure is a procedure in which the immigration court can basically temporarily take a case off the court's calendar. It's still technically pending in removal proceedings, so it's no longer active with the court. The person no longer has to attend hearings in immigration court. There's no future hearings scheduled, and the person is not in immediate risk of removal. And so administrative closure can also be used as a tool in many of the scenarios that, Chuck, that you were just discussing, particularly when the person is not detained and the type of application that the person is seeking is an application that is going to be adjudicated by another agency like USCIS, for example, a U visa that, like we were discussing, can take 15 months just to adjudicate. And after 16 months, it's not even non-immigrant status. It's simply deferred action, which could last another 5 years. And in that case, it really doesn't make sense to keep asking an immigration judge to grant continuances. Administrative closure would be a much better remedy in that scenario. And so I want to talk a little bit about the ins and outs of administrative closure and where that tool has evolved over the last couple of years. And so before the board's decision in matter of Avetisian in 2012, a copy of that decision is in the materials. The most immigration judges and the Board of Immigration Appeals were under the impression that administrative closure could only be granted if both parties agreed. However, in 2012, the board issued a published decision in Avetisian and indicated that that is not, in fact, true, and that both an immigration judge and the board can administratively close proceedings even if one of the parties opposes, as long as it's, as they say, otherwise appropriate under the circumstances. So the immigration judge or the board needs to weigh all the relevant factors, which includes why administrative closure is being sought, what the basis for any opposition is, the likelihood that the respondent will succeed on any petition that's pending or whatever else is the basis for the application, the anticipated duration of administrative closure, whether either party is contributing to any sort of delay in proceedings, and what the ultimate outcome of those removal proceedings may be. And so where we see administrative closure being super common, especially today, is when someone is not a priority. So Chuck mentioned the enforcement priorities. And what we are now seeing, at least in the San Francisco Immigration Court, and I believe this is nationwide, and the two of you can jump in on this, but what we are seeing is that in many cases where the person in removal proceedings is not an enforcement priority, we will do requests for prosecutorial discretion to the Office of Chief Counsel. They will agree, and then we'll submit a joint motion for administrative closure. So that's again, the more typical scenario of admin closure where it's a joint motion or an unopposed motion. But we are also seeing in the San Francisco Immigration Court judges granting administrative closure over the objection of the Office of Chief Counsel. And that tends to come up in cases where Office of Chief Counsel is insisting on us entering pleadings before they will agree to prosecutorial discretion or administrative closure. So, for example, in cases of special immigrant juvenile status where the state court proceeding is pending, We have been able to convince the immigration judge to administratively close for the duration of the state court proceedings without entering pleadings over the government's objection. That similarly happens with unaccompanied children seeking asylum before the asylum office. We'll seek administrative closure. We won't enter pleadings, and the judge will grant over the government's objection. And then that can also happen sometimes when U visa cases are pending. Generally, in San Francisco, we are able to get our administrative closure motions not opposed for a U visa case that's pending, as long as we provide the Office of Chief Counsel a copy of the U visa application and a receipt notice. Sometimes they still oppose if they feel like the application doesn't make a prima facie showing that the person is eligible, but in general, they do agree to administrative closure in those cases. And then what we are also seeing and have been very successful in is when a U visa case is adjudicated and put on the wait list and the person's granted deferred action, we are able to get the case terminated before the immigration judge. So we recalendar the case and then move to terminate based on the deferred action status. So neither the Office of Chief Counsel nor the judge are requiring that U non-immigrant status actually be granted before we can terminate. And then I also wanted to mention, Chuck talked about preference category visa petitions and how it is difficult to get a continuance for someone seeking adjustment of status when the basis of the adjustment is a preference category visa petition, because there's generally a long wait for that petition to become current. And so if the person in that situation is not an enforcement priority, often a better tool is to seek administrative closure so that the immigration court proceedings are on hold while the person is waiting for his or her priority date to become current. Though I will say that that generally only works if that person is adjustment eligible or is clearly I-601A eligible, because an immigration judge generally isn't going to administratively close the proceedings if the person, for example, would need 245I to adjust but is not 245I protected. And then just another place where we generally seek administrative closure for someone seeking a benefit before USCIS, we do it when TPS applications are pending before USCIS. And then also after TPS is granted, we generally are seeing judges granting administrative closure for TPS recipients as opposed to termination. So did either of you have any other input on administrative closure before I leap to TPS?
Sure. I think that where I practice in New York, that for a child, they're really treated with kid gloves. So, I mean, if you bring in the paperwork that you're pursuing the SIJAP, the Special Immigrant Juvenile Application and Family Court, the judge is very, very quick to admin close the case, and of course we'd like to push for termination. Then it gets rid of the case, and you don't have to recalendar it after you get the special findings order from family court. In almost all other types of matters, it's very, very difficult to get the case admin closed. I tried to get a case admin closed on a U visa, and DHS objected, and that was the end of that. So I know I've read a matter of Edavisian many times, and I brought it up to immigration judges many times, but I don't have a lot of success stories, with the exception of children and also with the exception of some adjustment cases that are a little bit hairy because of arrests and other issues where the IJ has gotten frustrated in the lengthy delay of the case and admin closed it or terminated it. But I don't have the same rosier outlook and an IJ feeling empowered to admin close a case when there's a U visa or a T visa pending. A lot of times we'll just say, you know what, let's just put this over for a year or for 9 months and come back and see what happens.
Chuck, any thoughts?
Well, and then one situation that comes up sometimes is when your client is detained and there's something like a U visa that, notwithstanding the detention, is going to last for a long time. You know, a while ago, and I'm, you know, kind of 10, 12 years ago, if you could get a case administratively closed, the government would release them from detention. What we're seeing around here is that they don't really want to, they don't like to administratively close detained cases at all. I think it may be in part that they feel like they might have to release them from detention, and particularly if, you know, there's a criminal situation, you may be in, under mandatory detention, so they might not even feel like they could administratively close it. Maybe they know they would be vulnerable to a lawsuit if they don't close it. For whatever reason, it does seem like administrative closure has become, at least around here, nearly impossible to achieve in the detained setting. I don't know if you all have other experiences on that. But.
Yeah, I would agree that it's much more difficult in the detained context simply because the judges are under pressure to move those cases along and get people out of detention, and so they're not administratively closing in that scenario. Even in San Francisco, it's really just a non-detained docket where we're able to use it extensively.
I think it's going to come up in the matter of Montiel context, because in New York, if you had a conviction that was on direct appeal, so the notice of appeal that was filed, they would terminate the case and your client would get out of jail if the DHS didn't appeal to the BIA. DHS recently started appealing to the BIA, and the BIA remanded, saying that the proper procedure is for the IJ to determine whether to admin close the case and give a continuance. Now, a criminal appeal in New York can take between 2 and 3 years at the least amount of time. So right now, we're just wondering whether the IJs will admin close the case, or I can't see them continuing and keeping somebody in jail for 2 years, but I wouldn't be surprised if it happened.
Well, thank you both for your input on that. And so now we're going to jump to talking briefly about TPS. So, like I mentioned a little while ago, in San Francisco, when a TPS application is pending or when it's approved, immigration judges are administratively closing proceedings. But what we wanted to talk about here is what happens when USCIS actually denies TPS. What can an immigration judge do about it? And so the case law and the regulations indicate that an immigration judge actually does have jurisdiction to adjudicate a TPS application. And there are two board decisions that talk extensively about that. One is Matter of Barrientos, which is a 2007 board decision, and the other is Matter of Lopez Aldana, a 2009 decision. Both of these cases are in the materials. And so what Matter of Barrientos said was that the immigration judge has the authority to review a TPS application de novo, even if the administrative appeals office denied appeals. So for someone applying for TPS, if USCIS denies that application in the first instance, the person can appeal to the administrative appeals office. And as Chuck was talking about, for continuances, for those of us who aren't in the San Francisco jurisdiction and can't get administrative closure while a TPS application is pending, continuances might be what are needed in that scenario. And then once that application is denied, it is much more difficult to get a continuance. And so, and even while that application is on appeal at the AAO, it might be difficult to convince the immigration judge to continue the proceedings again. And so what you can do instead, and what you and your client can do instead, is actually request that the IJ adjudicate the TPS application. And then you can have a hearing on the merits of that application for TPS. And the issue that came up in Matter of Lopez Aldana, which sort of bounced off of Matter of Barrientos, was whether an immigration judge has jurisdiction to adjudicate a TPS application if there is no decision yet from the AAO. And so the board in Lopez Aldana said yes, that the immigration judge does in fact have jurisdiction to adjudicate the application even if there's no final decision from the AAO. And so that's actually helpful in the context of trying to get continuances if you're really struggling to get the judge to grant you a continuance to allow the AAO to adjudicate the application. You can just go forward before the immigration judge. And the immigration judge's review of the TPS application is de novo. So, you know, the benefit in a situation like this is that you can present evidence in person. And so in certain scenarios where, you know, you feel that the TPS application was erroneously denied before USCIS, and you might be better able to convince the immigration judge with testimonial evidence or, you know, in-person oral arguments, it can actually be a benefit to be able to seek that application before the immigration judge. What I've seen in the past when I've tried to get immigration judges to adjudicate TPS applications is that it's something that they're not used to, they're not super comfortable with. So it is important to educate the immigration judge about their jurisdiction over this type of application because it is, you know, traditionally an application that is adjudicated by USCIS and not by an immigration judge. Any other thoughts on TPS from either of you?
I would just try to advise the listeners to see if the immigration judge that they're applying for TPS before has ever adjudicated a TPS application and what their standard is. Because I've heard about immigration judges having a brutal standard for granting TPS and then other judges having a very lenient standard. So while the IJ jurisdiction is in some sense a benefit, it could also be very, very difficult to keep your client in the country.
Right. That's a good point. And so in that situation, if you have a judge who you think is going to be really difficult in the adjudication, if you can, your better strategy is to get that appeal adjudicated by the AAO in the hopes that that will be granted before you have to bring it to the judge. Thank you, Paul. So now I'd like to move on to the question of standalone waivers before an immigration judge. And this is somewhat similar to the TPS context where a judge has the authority to adjudicate a waiver or a petition that's not something that is traditionally adjudicated by the immigration judge, where it's going to be the attorney's responsibility to kind of educate the judge on their authority. So, Todd, can you talk a bit about what kind of standalone waivers an immigration judge can consider when someone's in removal proceedings?
Sure. Now, you know, I think maybe one way to start is to actually compare the board decisions in matter of Abosi and matter of Rivas. So take a permanent resident. We mentioned the 212H situation. Take a permanent resident who commits some sort of criminal offense. Maybe she is not eligible for cancellation because she commits the offense within 7 years of becoming a permanent, of being admitted at any status and then becoming a permanent resident, so as to trigger the stop time rule and be barred from cancellation. The 212H has a sort of a different stop time provision. It stops only when the removal proceedings are initiated, and so you may have some individuals who would be eligible for a waiver under 212H, but would be not ineligible for cancellation. The waiver form, it's an I-601, usually, in my experience, maybe 99% of the time, is filed in conjunction with an application for either consular processing or an adjustment of status. But the board says that in some cases you can file it as a standalone, specifically when you're a permanent resident who leaves the country and comes back in. INA 101A13 renders many permanent residents with criminal convictions inadmissible when they return, and so that individual can be charged under 212, and then you can waive your inadmissibility under 212H with a standalone I-601. The reason I start with that is because it's relatively clear that judges can grant 601 waivers. They certainly do so in the adjustment context. And in this situation, you actually have two BIA decisions that explain when you can seek a standalone 212H waiver. Now, you might think, as Paul suggested, that there's a little bit of an equal protection issue with the person being eligible to seek this waiver if they happen to have traveled abroad and were detained upon return, but ineligible if they didn't travel abroad, or if they traveled abroad and for whatever reason got waived back in without anybody noticing that they were inadmissible to the country. And there was some good 11th Circuit, I know that's crazy, there was actually a good 11th Circuit case law saying, you know, this probably is an equal protection problem. Unfortunately, there have been a slew of, the board decision of Matter of Rivas said, well, look, the regulations require that you only get a standalone 212H in conjunction with an adjustment of status application, and circuit after circuit seems to be, you know, falling into line, deferring to that. Rivas itself was appealed to the 11th Circuit, which ruled predictably against Rivas. The 6th Circuit and Faisalina, the 5th Circuit, the 9th Circuit. So unfortunately, I'm afraid that permanent residents seeking a 212H waiver and I-601 might be limited to, you know, the situation where they're arriving aliens. But another standalone situation that comes up is sort of triggered by the 7th Circuit's decision in LDG. I'm going to talk about it. Let me just step back for a moment and mention how U visa waivers work. So a U visa, as you know, is a non-immigrant visa category. And so non-immigrant visas have, you know, separate waiver categories. There is Congress actually created a type of waiver that is specific to the U visa context, and so in short, a U visa applicant can seek either a waiver under INA 212D14 or under 212D3. D3A, to be precise. Now, the standards are similar, but a little bit different. There's certain kinds of, I would say there's about 99% overlap, but there are some little differences. For instance, a slightly larger subset of inadmissibility grounds can be waived under D14. I believe it may be can include even Nazis or something. I mean, it's just and the legal standard is slightly different. 212D14 asks for a waiver, allows for a waiver in the national or public interest. Whereas the 212D3A waivers are adjudicated under the factors outlined in a case called Matter of Hronka. Neither of them is an extreme hardship situation. They really are very similar, but they're not exactly the same. And so the agency, when it implemented U visa regulations, said, well, you know what? U visa applicants can seek waivers under either D3A or D14, and we will adjudicate them all like that, which is all well and good. Now, the statute in 212D14 is pretty clear that the agency which grants those waivers is USCIS. And for better or worse, U visas can only be adjudicated by DHS, that is to say USCIS, and not authority has not been granted over U visas to the immigration courts. But 212D3A is something which the courts have adjudicated sometimes. There have been a few contexts, particularly in past years, when immigration courts adjudicated non-immigrant waivers under 212D. The Seventh Circuit had considered actually a recent case of a woman who was seeking to enter on a fiancé visa and was alleged to be inadmissible for fraud, I believe, and also for a prior removal. So the Seventh Circuit already said that immigration judges can adjudicate these non-immigrant waivers under 212D3. And LDG brought that same argument to the Seventh Circuit in the U visa context. It argued, well, look, I'm eligible for a U visa except for the inadmissibility. The only basis for denying the U visa was the denial of the waiver. I want a waiver under 212D3. Please, immigration judge, grant me that waiver, and then I can get my U visa. The Seventh Circuit agreed that an immigration judge could grant a 212D3 waiver, which would then allow the non-citizen to be U visa eligible.
Sorry to interrupt. Can you talk a little bit about whether the IJ's authority in that context is the authority to review it as sort of a means of seeking review, or whether the immigration judge can review that waiver application before there's any adjudication by Vermont?
That's a great question. And I'll step back and say I think getting the immigration courts involved in this process is a crucially important one. And if it were only IJ review, it would still be a really good thing, because once the immigration court can decide on a particular issue, in this case a 212D3 waiver, that can be appealed to the board. And if you lose at the board, you can appeal to the Court of Appeals. And it results in a sort of a body of law, more consistency, one hopes, in the adjudication of those. And I'll also say the Vermont Service Center adjudicates U visas. They're remarkably good, at least historically, they've been quite good at granting waivers for unlawful presence, and for being here unlawfully, that sort of thing. But they have not been very good at all with regard to some, client who's committed a significant criminal offense. In the detained setting, even a non-citizen with a substantial or significant criminal offense, can sometimes get relief. It's not easy, but you can do it, right? And so getting the immigration court to be able to adjudicate these, you mentioned as well, at least, that not having to do it on a paper record can in some cases be very... Now, there's some cases where you would rather see it adjudicated on a paper record as opposed to having your client on the stand, but I think particularly where there's a significant criminal offense, you often want to get the client and their family members in there in court to with the full panoply of rights. So the Seventh Circuit said, look, 212D, this is not a situation where the immigration court is reviewing, a USCIS decision for error. It's basically a de novo decision whether to grant or not the waiver. And I would add, the Seventh Circuit actually sort of went out of its way to say, and you can do that even before the USCIS adjudicates the U visa. There's one little sort of weird wrinkle in the U visa. So for adjustment of status, right, we have as we all know, you file an I-130, there's a visa petition, that gets approved. The adjustment is a separate application. So where your client, for instance, committed a crime or did something else that rendered him inadmissible, you may very well have a situation where the visa petition is approved, yet you're married to that person in good faith, I believe it, they're a U.S. citizen, but you are a slime ball and we refuse to grant you adjustment of status. So you have an approved I-130 and you have a denied I-45. In the U visa context, for whatever reason, they don't have a bifurcated system. So you seek U visa and you seek non-immigrant status and as part of the same application. In other words, they don't they don't treat it as an application from the local prosecutor or police agency, you know, for you to be considered U visa eligible, then for you to ask for U visa status. It's just all one application. And so, unfortunately, when Vermont adjudicates a U visa application, if they deny the waiver, they deny the U visa. And there's not something that says you're approved to be considered eligible for U visa. All you have is a rambling boilerplate decision from the Vermont Service Center that denies your application. And so judges are put into a little bit of an awkward position when that happens. The Seventh Circuit saw its way to saying that the immigration court can grant a waiver, and their theory was that that would actually facilitate matters at the Vermont Service Center, which I think it would if the Vermont Service Center were to actually recognize authority of the immigration court to do this. The Seventh Circuit, there obviously is authority. I think Vermont is still having a little bit of an issue deciding what to do in these cases. At least in our experience, we because we're in the Seventh Circuit, we handle a good number of these applications, and we have been successful in convincing immigration judges to grant waivers in a number of cases, and Vermont is still scratching its head about what to do on a number of those cases. I think maybe all those cases. So.
Thanks, Chuck. So just in the interest of time, we are running short on time. I just wanted to make one quick comment on that and then move on to bond with Paul. I just wanted to mention that here in San Francisco, we are using LBG and making arguments to immigration judges that they have the authority to adjudicate waivers, and we have been able to convince judges that, in fact, they do have that authority. We haven't had any decisions yet because our individual hearings are set so far out, but on the jurisdiction issue, we have one in front of various different immigration judges. So thank you for that, Chuck. So, Paul, I wanted to move on to you. Briefly, we are getting short on time to talk about some interesting issues with respect to jurisdiction in bond proceedings. So first, I know there's sort of a novel issue floating around out there about whether you can request a bond hearing in a jurisdiction other than where the client is detained. There is a regulation that suggests that it is the immigration judge that has jurisdiction over the place of detention is the judge who would hold the bond hearing. But I know that's been challenged and been successful. Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure. This is one of my favorite topics because I love getting people out of jail. No one is ever happier than when they get out of jail. So this arises for me, and I'm sure arises for other practitioners in this context. You file a motion for a bond hearing with the immigration court where your client's located. You prep the exhibits. You file the exhibits. You prep any witnesses. You show up for the bond hearing. Your client doesn't appear. So you ask the trial attorney, did you decide to magnanimously release my client from detention? The trial attorney says, no, your client is in Oakdale or is in Etowah or some faraway destination. So I think this happens a lot. And people who are detained in Charlotte and Lumpkin, Georgia. Apparently, there's a lot of travel between Charlotte, North Carolina, and Lumpkin, Georgia. So Helen Parsonage, who's a great attorney, did an appeal on a case called Matter of Certa Reyes, which seems to say that the proper venue for a bond hearing does not necessarily follow the immigrant, that you could file the actual bond motion in the location where the immigrant is detained, and then if they get moved, you can pressure the IJ and pressure DHS to to bring your client back to that original location so that your client doesn't have to face a bond hearing in front of a new or different immigration judge, and you don't have to travel there to conduct the bond hearing. I read Matter of Certo Reyes, and it wasn't 100% explicitly clear in determining the proper venue for such a course of action or this course of procedure. However, it said that you could really pressure the IJ and push him to hopefully conduct the bond hearing in the jurisdiction where you actually filed it. Now, you can't just go filing bond motions in any jurisdiction. Like, I'm in New York. I can't file a bond motion in California. But I think that you have a great argument. And in the scenario where your client is transferred outside the court's jurisdiction after you file the bond motion, that the IJ should conduct the bond motion and should order DHS to bring your client back.
Great. And thanks, Paul. And just to point out, Matter of Certo Reyes is an unpublished board decision, and it is in our materials. And thank you for that. And then I just wanted to ask you, are there other interesting bond jurisdiction issues that you've encountered recently that you wanted to mention?
Sure. This is a super fun issue. It's very, very complicated. Now, under a matter of Sanchez, it says that no charging document must be filed with the immigration court for you to seek bond there. So the government doesn't have to file an NTA for you to seek bond there. So if you have a client who is detained and the charging document hasn't been filed with the court, you can go in there the next day and say, I want a bond hearing. It gets much more complicated when you have a client who has received an order of removal from the immigration judge, and the case is before the BIA or it was before the Court of Appeals. Because if you really sit down and you examine the detention statutes, either 1226 or 1231, there's times when your client's detention switches from 1231 to 1226. Now, once it goes back from 1231 to 1226, the immigration judge should have jurisdiction over your client's detention, and your client should be able to get an impartial and fair review of the conditions of his detention. Now, unfortunately, in my experience, it's been very, very difficult to get immigration judges and court clerks to even calendar these cases where there are no NTAs that filed and there's really nothing pending with the court. It specifically comes up when you file a petition for review with the Circuit Court of Appeals and the stay has been granted. Under that exact scenario, detention is supposed to switch back from 1231 to 1226. Now, unfortunately, when that happens, there's not an automatic mechanism of the Circuit Court of Appeals telling EOIR, okay, now you got to hold a bond hearing. It's up to you as an attorney to argue for a bond hearing, which has been very, very, very difficult in my experience.
Great. Thank you. And I would just note that, you know, for those of us who are lucky enough to be in the Ninth Circuit, when we do reach that stage of a case when someone is detained and they are on petition for review at the Ninth Circuit and there's a stay in place, that case does fall under casus custodiam in the Ninth Circuit, and that person does, in fact, get a bond hearing. So we don't have any difficulty in getting someone a bond hearing at that point in proceedings. So I want to thank you both, Chuck and Paul, for a very interesting discussion, and now I will turn it back over to JJ.
Thanks, Elise. For those of you who will be seeking CLE credit for your participation in this podcast, please make note of the following 4-digit attendance verification code. The 4-digit code is 9146. Again, the code is 9146. Please visit AILA's Web CLE Center at www.ailawebcle.org to record your CLE credit. Thank you very much to all of our speakers for sharing their knowledge and expertise, and to you for joining us today. That concludes our podcast.